Some commentators have suggested that President Donald Trump is a madman who is totally unpredictable and dangerous. Others have said he only acts like a madman to throw his enemies off balance. Thomas Reifer is a professor of sociology at the University of San Diego and an associate fellow at the Transnational Institute. He worked closely with whistleblower Daniel Ellsberg, whose last book was The Doomsday Machine, Confessions of a Nuclear War Planner. KGVM contributor David Rosenberg spoke with Reifer about Trump, the madman theory, and the wars in the Middle East.
What about the madman theory? Was this something that first came up, at least in modern times, with the Nixon administration, that he was going to somehow throw the North Vietnamese and Viet Cong off balance by kind of not letting them know just how crazy he was, or suggesting that he was crazy? And or does it go back a lot further than that?
It goes back a lot further. Actually, there's been a lot of discussion about it, but there hasn't been a discussion so much about two things. One is that apparently the Iranians had prepared a strategy following the 12-day war in June, where they were certain, and it turned out that they were correct, that the U.S. and Israel were going to attack again. And they prepared a strategy, and they prepared a plan of succession if Khomeini was killed. And their strategy was called Operation Madman. And that's what they're implementing now, basically. Now, it's kind of more understandable for them, though condemnable, which is that they're pressed to the wall and they're facing annihilation. So the idea that they're going to give up and face annihilation versus go down fighting on annihilation was a kind of crazy idea. But so they started implementing the strategy. And then the Wall Street Journal had an article that Trump may be facing his own Nixon moment. But actually, I knew about it because Dan Ellsberg, who I worked with very closely since I took a course with him when I was 16 years old in 1984, Nuclear Weapons and Foreign Policy, he had given a series of lectures in the late 1950s in the context of Khrushchev's threats, which then were largely bluffs against the U.S. This is at a time when Khrushchev was saying, we're turning out missiles like sausages, which was not true, actually. So the penchant for acting like a risky madman was a way to enforce the credibility of your threats and get your demands met at the bargaining table. But actually, the pioneer in the madman strategy was Adolf Hitler. That was the model for Ellsberg's lecture. Hitler was a very unique individual in that, of course, not that he relished the use of force, but that he was willing to take very desperate gambles early on. And this allowed him to take over many countries in Europe without firing a shot, actually. Of course, the problem is that in addition to just the condemnable aspect of that policy of wars of aggression and taking over countries, is that you get very heady about the possibility of your risks succeeding, and then that they can fail. So it actually goes back a long way. And I think there's been some misunderstanding because a colleague of mine had asked Dan Ellsberg, apparently in 2016, whether Trump was using the madman strategy. And Dan responded very accurately, no, Trump is a madman. Now, it depends on how you define madman.
Yeah, there's a debate about that, whether he's a madman or whether he's very calculated.
Yeah. Well, see, that depends on the definition. So Adam Smith talked about, versus what people know about Adam Smith, Adam Smith talked about morals and values as part of the things you have reason to reflect upon, reason to be. So he didn't define rationality outside of ethics. But his friend David Hume said, 'tis not irrational to prefer the destruction of the world to the scratching of my finger. You know, in other words, if those are your preferences and you act on it, I mean, it's kind of bizarre, but those are your preferences. So you can act rationally in that context. So here we have a unique situation. Noam Chomsky, I think, rightly said, and this was quite some time ago, that Donald Trump is the greatest criminal in human history. You know, Hitler didn't have the capacity at the time for catastrophic climate change. He didn't have nuclear weapons. And Trump is carrying out policies that maximize the destruction of the inhabitability of the world for sentient beings. So by any reasonable definition, he's a madman. But in the context of his preferences, he can act like a fox, very rational, right? So it turns out that Ellsberg said later, when he published his book, The Doomsday Machine, that Trump also cultivates this use of being a madman. Now he's got a particularly difficult situation because we're in a stalemated war. It's like Vietnam in that sense. The war is stalemated. So they don't admit we're at war. They say there's a ceasefire, and they say the firing, well, that's not breaking the ceasefire. We're responding to their we're responding to them responding to our naval blockade. So they can't admit that there's a war, one, because the War Powers Act comes into play, which Trump says is unconstitutional, but they're still worried about it. So they can't admit that they're in a war, which they're losing. What is the war?
But he already declared that they won, that the U.S. won.
We're winning, but they won't surrender somehow. This, you know, these obstinate people, they won't surrender. We've won. What have we won? We had stopped their nuclear program under Obama with the agreement that Trump pulled out of. So what we have, quote, won is that we have the greatest energy shock in world history and the U.S. is losing and being humiliated. Well, that's consistent with Trump. He's bankrupted at every business he had. Now he's bankrupting the country. He's a loser. But in his idiom, the greatest insult is to say you're a loser. So he has to say he's constantly winning. But he's got a real problem, which is the strait isn't open. It's not going to open given his maximalist demands. And yet the only thing he cares about is his poll numbers. So he has a real dilemma. What's he going to do? Now, here's the problem. If Trump thinks he's going down, this is a guy who'll bring down everything around him, like Hitler, Goddard Dameron, you know, just level it all, right? And he's facing the midterm elections, which he basically has decided he's going to throw away the affordability thing and now just say the only way the Democrats can win the election is if they're stealing it. So we have the prospect of, you know, fascist ethnic cleansing at home and basically a fascist-like aggressive war policy abroad. And one of the things about Dan Ellsberg's work is that out of the Pentagon Papers, he came up with this notion called the desperate proposal pattern. When leaders face an immediate loss, and this was in Vietnam, and you can also see it happening today, they try to avert losses by increasingly risky, desperate, and murderous gambles, even against ever-increasing odds, betting that maybe they'll come out even or ahead. We cannot count on this guy, Trump, to back down. And we shouldn't count on the Iranians to back down either. Now, that's an extraordinarily dangerous situation.
So we could be looking at a wider war.
Oh, absolutely. And what the New York Times has revealed in this incredible visualization is that this is a world war. It's drawn in all sorts of powers, including China and the Ukraine and Russia, et cetera, et cetera. And it combines with a war that's already existing between Russia and the Ukraine, not to mention the U.S. face-off with China. And this is in an era of thermonuclear weapons. But yet, aside from, you know, KPFK and KPFA, we're in this Orwellian media environment that's like The Onion, where you read the newspaper, the New York Times, and it says, Trump declares there is no war while missiles fly. I mean, it's like The Onion, except The Onion is now the New York Times.
There's an aspect of his presidency also that resembles kind of professional wrestling, kind of this bombastic.
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah.
Masculinity. It's part of the whole fascist masculinity and Mussolini and so on and so forth. By the way, about his threats on April 7th, which happened to be Dan Ellsberg's birthday, if he was still alive. So on April 7th, Trump threatened to destroy Iranian civilization. It was obviously a nuclear threat, which he later denied making. But he also did an interview in which he said he was willing to carry out the threat. See, he will never admit that he was bluffing, because that decreases the credibility of threats. Now, here's the thing. In his interview with the New York Times in January after the Venezuela operation, they asked him if there was anything that limited his power. He said, yes, my own mind, my own morality. He doesn't care about international law. He's not looking to hurt anybody. Okay, this is a guy who said, well, he wanted the Nobel Peace Prize, which he didn't get. Now he's no longer thinking solely in terms of peace. Does anybody think that this guy, aside from his own interest, would care about dropping a nuclear weapon? Okay, he said the other day nobody should use it. But he says a lot of different things. Trump has no sense of morality involving what people usually associate with morality, other people in the world. Because
I do remember he said in the Iran context, when he found out supposedly that some U.S. attack was going to actually kill people, he kind of called a halt to it. Do you remember that? He didn't want to see people get killed, that kind of thing.
Well, he sometimes says it.
Like when he said, I don't want these stupid wars, because he thought.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. Well, of course, he's condemned all these wars. Totally stupid, idiotic. And now he's in one, of course. And the U.S. and Israel are in one. That's the other thing. Netanyahu's payoffs are very different, right? There's overwhelming support for the war in Israel. And Trump is also facing, Netanyahu is also facing an election. And what does he have to show for it? So the ceasefire in Lebanon is not holding. So there's war, there's no peace, but people are declaring there is peace, and they're basically saying that war is peace. Meanwhile, you have this ever-increasing prospect for escalation, because how does this end? Well, it could end very simply. Trump says he's concerned about the nuclear program. Fine, declare a nuclear weapons-free zone in the Middle East, but there's a problem with that. The U.S. and Israel would have to admit what everybody knows, which is that Israel has nuclear weapons, which they won't do. There's another thing you do, because this whole issue is entwined with the Israel-Palestine problem. There's overwhelming support for the two-state solution. It's not a perfect solution, but it's a solution that the vast majority of states in the world agree to.
Although there's more talk now about a one-state solution.
Well, the thing is that I agree with my friend Noam Chomsky, and there's a lot of disagreement about it. Aside from Iran, it has no international support among states, and therefore it's impossible. People say, well, there's already a one state, so on and so forth. Well, there's an apartheid state, including the occupation. So the thing is, I just think, I mean, it should be discussed and debated, because I have colleagues that I respect a lot that I disagree. But again, in terms of a long range vision of people living in peace, one state, yes, of course. But right now, you have an Israeli state, which is a Jewish state. Now, I'm Jewish, and I don't believe in any confessional states or any religious-based states. But Israel's not going to stop being a Jewish state tomorrow. So there is this internationally accepted solution, which over time could transform into something else.
It could still be like a Jewish homeland, I guess.
Yeah, exactly. And people talked about a binational state. There's various possibilities in terms of that. But the question is, how do you get there? And I don't see any way to get there without taking something that is accepted by the vast majority of states in the world versus being accepted by one state, Iran. And so there's a lesson for the peace movement and solidarity movement here, too. And of course, people will respectfully debate and disagree on these things, which is that it's important to not let the perfect be the enemy of the good. There is this internationally accepted solution among the states. Increasingly in the movement, people don't believe it, including close friends of mine. They all talk about the one state solution. But what they miss is the other option, which is that you just get the expansion of greater Israel and a situation of apartheid. That's the likely scenario. Yes, people are living, quote unquote, together under this apartheid situation. But right now, given the situation in Israel, you couldn't have anything else without people killing each other, and without the Israelis killing the Palestinians. So the question is, how do you get to something else? Noam Chomsky and other people never believed in the idea of a separate Jewish state, maybe a binational state or something like that.
Which the PLO proposed in the 60s, yeah.
Exactly. And the thing is that Chomsky argues that from 67 on, after the Israeli war of aggression, which isn't understood as such, that you have the possibilities for something different. But the question is, how do you get there? And I haven't had the chance to talk to some of my Palestinian and Palestinian-American colleagues in depth about this or not. And I just have a diametrically opposed view. There is one issue about it, though, that's important. I don't believe in the two-state solution because it makes me feel good. And the thing is that we have to be careful about purism. You know, let's have a solution that we feel good about, right? It's the best thing. Two-state solution isn't a perfect solution, doesn't solve all the problems, but it would be an enormous advantage ending the occupation. Now, people say it could end up being just a tiny state, apartheid-like, so on and so forth. Well, we have to make sure it's not that. And here's the thing. The vast majority of Americans don't know that there's an internationally accepted solution to this problem and that the U.S. and Israel are blocking it. Same thing on the nuclear issue, right? Okay, Trump says that he wants to deal with Iranian nuclear weapons. Fine, declare a nuclear weapons-free zone in the Middle East. So I think it's important for the movement to press the U.S. on things that we can say, look, there's overwhelming support for these things. Let's put the pressure on, stop the arms going to Israel. And actually, recently, some Democrats also wrote to the administration saying, we want to know about Israel's nuclear weapons and nuclear policy. So there's pressure along these things. And I think that we ought to go for the maximum point of pressure. And of course, the larger situation is to stop neo-fascist ethnic cleansing at home and this fascist-like policy dismantling international law abroad. But right now, we have to deal with the likelihood that this stalemated war is going to escalate, and it's going to escalate at home, and it's going to escalate internationally. And it may be that before the midterm elections, Trump decides he's going to go for broke. He says they have this peace plan that Iran is considering, And if they don't agree to it, he says, the bombing will begin again and it's going to be more intense than the first. So who knows what it'll do? I don't know what it'll do.
So do you think that regardless of what Trump or the Iranians do, the war kind of has a momentum of its own?
Yes. And one of the reasons it has a momentum is because Trump, he keeps on declaring victory, but he has to be willing to stop the war. A naval blockade is an act of war. So they say that we're in a ceasefire. Well, how can you have a ceasefire when you're carrying out an act of war? Trump could try to declare victory, even though it's obviously not a victory. But if he's not willing to do that, then we have a problem. And then there's Netanyahu. And then there's the situation in Lebanon. This is an entwined war. Well, people say, well, we have to deal with Hezbollah. Well, Hezbollah came into existence because of Israel's 1982 invasion of Lebanon. Not to mention then you get Hamas, so on and so forth, right? So one of the reasons why this current war, entangled war, is so complicated is because of the earlier wars of the past, which, as Ellsberg notes, from which we've learned nothing. It's not that we've made mistakes, he said, is that we've learned so little from them. And we're heading off a precipice. And the U.S.
For the U.S. leaders, their thing was we have to get rid of the Vietnam syndrome.
There's a very important lesson here, because the reason why Nixon's threats didn't work was because of this massive anti-war movement. And the movement didn't know it at the time. There's a wonderful PBS documentary called The Movement and the Madman. Nixon was making these nuclear threats privately. And this was his November ultimatum, but there was millions of people on the streets. So I think that the fact is that the anti-war opposition to this war, in the context of Trump saying all these wars are stupid, how could you be so stupid? Well, you could be as stupid as Trump, pretty stupid, but smart like a fox. But there's this anti-war movement. There's disapproval of these wars. And this has limited his ability to escalate. But don't be sure he won't do it in the future, especially because why would the Iranians open the strait unless the U.S. and Israel say, we will not attack you again? Iran's demand for the war is ceasefire in Lebanon with Hezbollah, which is an Iranian proxy, but also has some support, has significant support among the Shia of Lebanon because of this greater Israel idea. And so these are entwined things, but Trump and Netanyahu are not willing to make a deal. They keep on putting it on the Iranians and Hezbollah, but that's not the problem. They didn't start a war of aggression. The U.S. and Israel did. Now, where does the concept of a war of aggression come? Well, most famously from Nuremberg, which was created by the U.S. and its allies. It said, wars of aggression, crimes against peace, are the supreme evil which embodies the accumulated evil of the whole. And specifically, it had to do with the fact that the war of aggression against what the Nazis called Judeo-Bolshevism, against Russia and Eastern Europe, was a war of annihilation. By the way, in a different context, like Israel's war against Gaza after the October 7th massacre of Israelis by Hamas. Same thing, war of annihilation. In fact, a friend of mine said, well, it's not war, it's genocide. Well, it's a war of genocide. That's what it is. That was the intention. It was a war of revenge, right? But what's the source of all this? Next year, the U.S. supported Israel military occupation will be 60 years, the longest military occupation in modern history. Why are we funding it? Why are we supporting it? Well, the U.S. under Biden said, well, Israel can't give it up because of their security. It has been the main source of Israel's insecurity. Israel picked expansion over security, and the U.S. picks world domination over security every single day, to the detriment of people in the U.S., to detriment of people around the world. And now they want to increase the military budget by another $500 billion. So we're heading towards the precipice, and don't think that President Trump won't bring the whole world down with him. If he goes down, the whole world might as well go down. So people need to know that the possibilities for escalation and repeating the same type of logic that led to more desperate gambles in Vietnam are very possible here, unless there's an end to the war and a commitment by the U.S. and Israel that they will stop attacking Iran and Lebanon.
So with this CIA analysis saying that Iran can hold out for two more months at least, as opposed to what Trump says that we've decimated their forces, do you think that Trump is paying any attention to that?
Paying any attention to what?
The idea that Iran can hold out for far more than the U.S. leaders are saying.
It's hard to say. Trump just seems, to not comprehend how they cannot be surrendering. But this is part of what the Pope talked about, right? This idea of, you know, dominating the world and just this idea that you can control everything. Remember that in the Atlantic about a year or two ago, Trump said, I control the U.S. and I control the world. No, you don't control the U.S. and you don't control the world. I think that he thinks that the Iranians, he's kept on saying they have to back down, except guess what? They don't have to back down, just like the Vietnamese didn't have to back down, and they weren't going to back down. Nixon chose aims in Vietnam that the Vietnamese weren't going to agree to, and Trump is doing the same thing. So Trump could end the war tomorrow, but he doesn't want to unless he can appear victorious. At this point, that's a pretty dismal prospect. How can we see it changing? It's hard to see how he gets out of it unless he somehow declares victory and tries to sell it to the public, given that he can't admit that he's a loser, because that's the worst thing in the world for him. Humiliation, shame, can't stand that.
So it isn't a situation where a president can use a war to regain lost popularity.
Absolutely not. This is the least popular war, as far as we know, in American history, except for the 30-40% of the American public who will support Trump no matter what. And by the way, that was very consistent with, there was a huge amount of support for Hitler up until the end of the war, total catastrophe. But it was like a cult-like fascist leader, like in the U.S. Trump, it doesn't matter what Trump does, you know. I think another thing that people could do is they should put pressure on Congress, right, to effectuate the War Powers Resolution. They have to give their say if military forces are still in the field. So Congress and or the courts, under the pressure of public opinion, could stop the war. Don't count on this president to stop the war. Yeah, he wants the war to stop. Like John Lennon, you know, the war is over if you want it. So Trump just says the war is over. There's no war.
Are you at all encouraged by some of the MAGA people like Marjorie Taylor Greene or Tucker Carlson, those type, or Candace Owens kind of turning against him, or that's just not enough?
Well, Tucker Carlson, given his support for Nazi-like ideology, I can't ever say anything positive about. But as we all say, you know, even a clock is right twice a day. You know, right. Dan used to say you can't count on people being wrong all the time. Yeah. And it is true that there was a source of the MAGA base that was against the war. And I'm all in favor of converting people who were part of Trump supporters to realize that this is madness, that this is fascism, that there's another way. You know, it's not like we're winning and we should shun all people who've supported positions that we didn't like in the past. We should say, no, like in Orbán's Hungary, these people are not helping you. This strategy of xenophobia is not good. And let's come on to a broader progressive movement for social change in the U.S. and the world.
That's University of San Diego Professor Thomas Reifer speaking with KGVM contributor David Rosenberg. This interview was released on May 26th, 2026.